Welcome back to Grace to You as we continue our study of looking at 12 unlikely heroes. Each week we look at another person that God used mightily throughout the scriptures. Today we have an individual, a young man who God used in a mighty way to save the life of the king of Israel. He also used this young man to define biblical friendship. Who was he? Well, why don't you stay and find out. Today on Grace to You.
You would assume that the realization that he would never be king would kill some long-fed expectations that a young man might develop. He didn't just merely accept his non-kingly role. He embraced it with all his heart, giving up all personal honor, personal power, position for a friend, because he knew that was God's will. What in the world makes us so embarrassed about the gospel? I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. First Samuel 23:16 and 17 says, "Then Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David in the woods and strengthened his hand in God. And he said to him, 'Do not fear, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find you. You shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you.'" 1 Samuel 23:16 and 17. That picks up the story fairly well down the path when Jonathan has already established a friendship with David and is David's great protector, even though David will be the king that Jonathan might have been had his father's line not been cursed. So we're going to look at this story. We're going to look at relationships, okay? Our first beginning point will be Israel's first royal family. And we're going to be looking at that family, namely Saul, and in particular, a son of Saul by the name of Jonathan. He doesn't get introduced till the 13th chapter, so it'll be a little bit before we get there. But he's going to be our target person. We're going to see the monarchy through the experience of Jonathan. He grew up not in the house of a king, because Saul was not a king until he was appointed a king. He was a farmer. He was a farmer. He's an interesting person. When he was a teenager, according to the opening verses of chapter 9, several of his grandfather's donkeys went missing, and animals were very valuable. So Jonathan's father, Saul, went looking for his father, Jonathan's grandfather's, donkeys. An extensive search for the donkeys failed to locate the missing animals, and Saul ran into the prophet Samuel while he's looking for his father's donkeys. And we pick this up down in verse 20 of chapter 9. "And Samuel says to Saul," who is a farmer looking for his father's donkeys, nothing more than that, "'As for your donkeys, which were lost 3 days ago, do not set your mind on them, for they have been found. And for whom is all that is desirable in Israel? Is it not for you and for all your father's household?'" What does that mean? Samuel is explaining to him that he, Saul, the farmer looking for the donkeys, will be Israel's first king. The desire of Israel for a king will fall to his house and his father's house. He will be that first king. When Saul went home, as we get into chapter 10, he went home from his meeting with Samuel. He shyly kept his coming elevation to king a secret. Chapter 10, verse 16 tells us that. And when it was time for him to be brought forward, down in verse 22 of chapter 10, he's hiding in the baggage. This is tall, dark, and handsome Saul, who is a coward of sorts, timid, and that insecurity and cowardice and timidity continually characterized his rule. He was a man full of fear, faltering in his confidence, paranoid of potential rivals, acting rashly as paranoid people do to compensate for his ineptness as a leader and his lack of fortitude. Into that family comes this young man, Jonathan. And one wonders how Saul's family, and especially Jonathan, responded when they first heard the astonishing news that their father, the farmer, who looked good on the outside but was weak on the inside, was going to be the king, first king of Israel's monarchy. So that's an introduction to the first sort of relationship between Saul and Jonathan. I want to follow that a little bit further, the relationship of Jonathan and Saul as it kind of develops. Going back to chapter 8 for a moment, we got ahead of ourselves, but we're going to be doing this. Israel's primary expectation for its new king was that he would protect them. Chapter 8, verse 20. He would be their great protector. He can go out before us and fight our battles. That's what they expected. Well, no sooner had Saul been put into place, go over to chapter 11, the Ammonites are engaged in a battle, in a war. 1 Samuel 11:13, Saul led the Israelites to a God-given victory, a God-given victory over the Ammonites. The Lord has accomplished, verse 13 says, deliverance in Israel. So this is what kings do, and it started well with a victory. A greater challenge, however, came less than 2 years into Saul's reign when he was accompanied by a standing army of 3,000 men, and he found himself in a dangerous conflict with the Philistines. However, Israel's king Saul has no need to fear, because according to chapter 9, verse 16, the Lord promised to deliver Israel from the Philistines. It is in the context of this conflict with the Philistines, 2 years into Saul's reign, that Jonathan first appears, probably a teenager, maybe at most in his early 20s. Old enough, however, according to chapter 13, look at it, Saul chose for himself 3,000 men of Israel, and then 1,000 were with Jonathan at Gibeah of Benjamin. Jonathan, as a teenager, or at most in his early 20s, is in charge of 1,000 men, 1,000 soldiers in the army of Israel. Saul is waiting at Michmash in the hill country of Bethel, and he's waiting. Jonathan, however, doesn't wait. While Saul waits, Jonathan, with his men, attacks the Philistine garrison at Geba and captures it. Geba is about 3 miles from the original capital in Israel called Gibeah. We don't know whether Saul ordered this attack or not, or whether Jonathan acted independently. It seems as though he acted independently. It was Jonathan, however, who gained the victory. It was Jonathan who initiated the critical military action. It was his plan. It was his triumph. But that conflict escalated into full-scale war, which gave Jonathan more opportunity and more opportunity to prove himself courageous, to prove himself a capable leader, and much more so than his apprehensive father, who would rather sit and wait until something good might happen. The Israelites perhaps expected only a small retaliation, a measured retaliation from their enemies, but instead the Philistines were furious at this assault and victory at Geba, and so they came back with thousands of chariots, thousands of horsemen, and infantry men. According to chapter 13, if you look down at verse 5, they numbered 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and people like the sand which is on the seashore in abundance. An uncountable number to rain vengeance on the Hebrew army for the success of Jonathan's campaign at Geba. And Israel's army was massively outnumbered. Saul's men reacted not in faith and courage, but in total fear. Look what happened to Saul's men. Verse 6, the men of Israel saw they were in a strait, for the people were hard-pressed. Then the people hid themselves in caves, in thickets, in cliffs, in cellars, and in pits. Those people hiding themselves are the soldiers. That's the army. More of them crossed the Jordan River and just went AWOL, fled. So many of them fled. Down in verse 15, Saul numbered the ones that were left, and there were 600. They've all fled with the same kind of cowardice and fear that was characteristic of their king. And so there sits Saul waiting in mortal fear in Gilgal with nothing left but 600 men. And by the way, he had no reason to be so paralyzed and traumatized. He had no reason to fear a massacre because Samuel had earlier said to him, and I quote from chapter 10, verse 8, "You shall go down before me to Gilgal, and surely I will come down to you to offer burnt offerings and make sacrifices of peace offerings. 7 days you shall wait till I come to you and show you what you should do. You are going to be at Gilgal. You stay there, wait 7 days, and I will come." And so there sits Saul at Gilgal, waiting, knowing the Philistines are amassing the army of vengeance. On the seventh day, then, Saul collapses in fear. Samuel has not arrived. In desperation, he can wait no longer. His enemy is getting stronger and bolder. His own forces are dissipating in cowardice. And so he decides not to wait for Samuel, who was an authorized offerer of sacrifice, and to do it himself. Chapter 13, verse 9, Saul said, "Bring to me the burnt offering and the peace offering." And he offered the burnt offering. He invaded the priesthood. And that was a tragic thing to do. He sought blessing through disobedience. Blessing doesn't come through disobedience. And like a scene from some classic comic sketch, as soon as Saul offered the sacrifice, the next verse says Samuel showed up. As soon as he finished offering the burnt offering, verse 10, Samuel came. Saul went out to meet him and to greet him. But this was no comedy. The old indignant prophet was not amused. So Samuel says to him, "What have you done?" in verse 11. "What have you done?" And it rocks Saul's conscience. Samuel's words to Saul were a stinging indictment. There's no adequate answer. There's no valid excuse. There's no defense. Samuel's command to Saul to stay there in Gilgal for 7 days was a test of whether or not he would be obedient to God, because that command was from God through Samuel. Earlier, Samuel had warned the Israelites that even under their new monarchy, if they failed to obey the Lord, they would be swept away in judgment along with their king. That's in chapter 12, verse 25. Obedience is always the way to blessing. Disobedience always the way to judgment. And so Saul is dishonoring the Lord. Saul has doomed his dynasty. No son of his will ever reign. Jonathan doesn't know that. He will never be king. He doesn't yet know that. In fact, you would assume that the realization that he would never be king would kill some long-fed expectations that a young man might develop and be devastatingly disappointed. Yet, as we will see, Jonathan's response was completely different than that, which is what makes him such an unlikely hero. On the other hand, Jonathan decides to attack the Philistines. Remember now, he doesn't know about this. As you come into chapter 14, Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man carrying his armor, "Come, let us cross over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side." But he didn't tell his father. So he wasn't with his father. He doesn't know about the curse that's come on the family. So he and his armor bearer have to scale some cliffs that are both slippery and sharp. Slippery rocks and sharp edges. to get access into an enemy garrison. This is a suicide mission. Two men? But notice verse 6. Then Jonathan said to the young man who was carrying his armor, "Come, let us cross over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. Perhaps the Lord will work for us, for the Lord is not restrained to save by many or by few." That famous statement came from the lips of Jonathan. He is fearless because he has placed his faith firmly in the promised will and power of God, who has declared that God will deliver his people from their enemies. And Jonathan will put himself in a position to see God fight for them. And the Lord will honor Jonathan's faith. They scale the cliff, he and his armor bearer. They come into the garrison, and according to verses 13 and 14, they are very successful. The slaughter involves 20 men. The two of them basically kill 20 Philistine soldiers. When the Philistine army began to realize what was happening, fleeing soldiers from the garrison going every direction, struck with fear, began to scatter. At that point, according to verse 15, the Lord struck further terror into their hearts by bringing an earthquake. And then what happened? Verse 20, Saul and all the people who were with him rallied and came to the battle. Behold, every man's sword was against his fellow, and there was very great confusion. By the time Saul arrived, the Philistines had killed each other. The same thing had happened with Gideon. The Lord was able to deliver with many. The Lord was able to deliver with few. By God's power, Jonathan, not Saul, was the one who set in motion Israel's victory. He is the one who launched the victory with his 1,000 men. The weakness of Saul continues to be made manifest. The contrast between him and Jonathan more pronounced. And that contrast becomes crystallized into clarity when a young shepherd arrives on the scene by the name of David. And now we move from the relationship of Saul and Jonathan to the relationship of Jonathan and David. This is where we come to know and love the story. By failing to trust the Lord and offering sacrifices before Samuel arrived, Saul proved, and there were many other ways it demonstrated, he was an incompetent leader who turned everything into a royal mess. He only accelerated his own self-destruction as his reign continued. But while he is still hanging on to the throne for a while, David's royal training begins. It is in chapter 16 and verse 12 that we begin to meet David. In fact, his name appears in verse 13. That's the introduction that we have to David. When the king was terrorized, you remember, by an evil spirit, David, already a gifted musician, was chosen to play the harp for him. That's from verse 14 on down to verse 23. David becomes the official royal harpist. Still living in Bethlehem, by the way, he would go to the palace and he would soothe the king with his music. When the Philistine giant Goliath threatens the Israelites, in the 17th chapter, this young boy goes from being a musician to being a killer, a great soldier who brings down Goliath with a slingshot, cuts off his head, secures the victory. David had the opportunity to be in the palace then on a permanent basis, to learn the elements of royal life, but most importantly, to prove that he could be used powerfully in the hands of God. And sparked by the incident with Goliath, a deep friendship develops between Jonathan and David. Let's pick that up in chapter 18. It came about when he had finished speaking to Saul that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David. Jonathan loved him as himself. This is just an amazing thing. Here is the one chosen by God, anointed by Samuel, David, to be the king that Jonathan will never be. Jonathan's love and loyalty is amazing. He loved him as his own soul. Jonathan means gift from the Lord, and he would prove to be that for David. David is a victorious leader. He has royal musician duties in the palace, and he has married the king's daughter. So the king is his father-in-law, and the prince is his brother-in-law. And to add to that, the story begins to tell us that David is immensely popular with the people. And Saul becomes more and more threatened with David. His dynasty is cursed. His throne is cursed. He is cursed. His kingdom will not last. And he continually grows suspicious of this young, powerful champion. And he decides he needs to murder him. And this is where we say the plot thickens. Verse 3 again of chapter 18, Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. He stripped himself of the robe that was on him, gave it to David with his armor, including his sword and his bow and his belt. He wanted to do anything he could for his friend and brother-in-law. He knew that David would have no human capability of surviving unless he had some friend in the court, somebody to warn him, somebody to protect him. And he had an ally in the royal court, his friend and brother-in-law, Jonathan. Their hearts had been knit together because they made a covenant of loyalty to each other. And do you know how that story plays out? When Saul threatened to kill David, the prince would warn David. The prince would come to David so that he could escape Saul. When first Jonathan told David that Saul wanted him dead, he was really surprised. But he wanted to be sure of the evil king's intentions. So go down to chapter 20. And David says to Jonathan down in verse 5 of chapter 20, let's have a simple test here to remove any doubt. David has a hard time believing that this king really wants him dead. And so David says to Jonathan, "Indeed, tomorrow is the new moon. I shall not fail to sit with the king to eat. But let me go that I may hide in the field until the third day at evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, 'David earnestly asked permission of me that he might run over to Bethlehem, a city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family,' which was true. If he says thus, 'It is well,' your servant will be safe. If he's very angry, be sure that evil is determined by him." Go down to verse 30. Where is David? Why is he not here? Verse 28. Jonathan says he has to go to Bethlehem. Verse 30, Saul's anger burned against Jonathan. And he said to him, "You son of a perverse, rebellious woman." That has a modern equivalent, by the way. "Do I not know that you are choosing the son of Jesse to your own shame and the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on this earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Therefore now send and bring him to me, for he must surely die." This exposes the venomous hatred of Saul for David. That's the test that validates Jonathan's warnings to David. And David says, "Okay, I get it. I get it." Jonathan defends his friend's honor, and it infuriates the king even more. Do you remember what happened? Saul grabs a spear and in a fit of rage launches it across the dinner table at his son Jonathan's head, narrowly missing. And Jonathan made a fast exit. Now everybody knows that he wants David dead. And you remember how the story goes from here. Jonathan goes out into the field now to tell David how the test went. Takes a servant, shoots some arrows. Remember, they had a little code. If the arrow goes beyond the servant, David's hiding. He shoots an arrow, goes past his servant. David knows that if it goes past the servant, that's code for Saul is angry and set to kill you. The servant heads back to the city. David emerges from hiding, says goodbye to Jonathan. Two men wept. And they wept out of this amazing love and affection that they had for each other. David went back into hiding, Jonathan back into the city. Listen, Saul spent the rest of his life hunting David. The rest of his life. During those same years, with Saul trying to kill David and David trying to escape, Jonathan found ways to meet his friend, to encourage him, to reiterate his loyalty, his love. Chapter 23, verse 17, the prince once explains to David, "Do not fear, for the hand of Saul, my father, shall not find you. You shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you. Even my father Saul knows that." This is the character of Jonathan, willingly giving up his own claim to the throne because he understood that the Lord had chosen David instead of him. No jealousy. This is a rare character quality, is it not? Jonathan's character is evident most clearly in his attitude toward David. Jonathan was a mighty warrior, noble prince, loyal friend. But it was his unwavering faith in the purpose and word of God that makes him an unlikely hero. Jonathan didn't just merely accept his non-kingly role. He embraced it with all his heart and became the friend and protector of the one who was put in his place. This is a man of great character. Great character. What is Jonathan's legacy to us? What makes him an unlikely hero? Selfless, noble prince, humble, loyal, loving, eager to obey God, giving up all personal honor, personal power, position for a friend because he knew that was God's will. If jealousy is the ugliest of human virtues, its absence is the most beautiful.
Next time on Grace to You.
It identifies government as an institution established by God in all its forms, for the punishment of those who do evil and for the protection of those who do good. Submit to the government and pay your taxes. But you may come to a point where you have to disobey the government. Here is where the authority of the government ends, when the government forbids you to do what God commands you to do.